Make sure you're subscribed to Issues Etc. Type Issues Etc. in your podcast provider, hit that subscribe button, and leave us a 5-star review. This will make it easier for other podcast listeners to find Issues Etc.
Is your school or homeschool ready to take the next step in teaching students with learning challenges? We can help. The Simply Classical curriculum, voted number one for special learners, is available from Memoria Press for students with autism, learning disabilities, or Down syndrome. We provide everything you need for a full year. Use promo code LPR21 at simplyclassical.com. Simplyclassical.com.
Adoption is a good thing, especially when placed over against abortion. Pro-lifers say adoption is an option. It's a life-giving option. It's a way of protecting the unborn from the horrors and the death of abortion. But does that mean that adoption always protects the rights of children? What's the difference between adoption and donor conception? Why should we recapture the idea that adoption is child-centered? It's for the child, not for the parents who want a child. Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. We're going to conclude our series on the need for a global children's rights movement. Today, we're going to talk about adoption. Katie Faust joins us. She's founder and director of the children's rights organization Them Before Us, and she's co-author of the new book, also called Them Before Us. Katie, welcome back.
Hi, so good to be with you again.
Pro-life people support adoption, and as it's a way to protect the unborn, a marvelous way. But does that mean that adoption is always friendly to children's rights?
Yeah, it's such a good question. And obviously, as an adoptive mom, you know, adoption is very close to my heart. And it is important for us to recognize that adoption is something that sometimes is necessary in this world. I know that it comes up a lot in the pro-life debate, where we want adoption to be an alternative to women who are experiencing unplanned pregnancies. But we also need to be careful that we think about adoption rightly, that it is an institution that is centered around the rights and needs of children. It's not a way for adults to get kids. So we begin discussing that in our chapter on adoption in the book, because first of all, we need to make sure that we have a proper understanding of adoption.
How has adoption become about adults rather than children?
Well, I think that we've had a lot of conversations about adoption in the sense that what's kind of been in the news in the last couple of years is these battles over adoption agencies and whether or not adoption agencies need to be forced to place children with LGBT adults or same-sex couples. And you've got people on the other side who are arguing that gay people have a right to adopt, and they have a right to parenthood, they have a right to adopt. And our perspective is gay people do not have a right to adopt. Heterosexual people don't have a right to adopt either. No adult has a right to a child that is not biologically theirs. Rather, children who have lost their parents have a right to be adopted. And so the focus of adoption must always be on the best interest of the child.
You say that adoption begins with loss. What do you mean by that?
Well, I think that we have, in some ways, partially because we desperately want children to not be aborted. We want them to have a chance at life. And so we have, in some cases, over-romanticized adoption. We have minimized the suffering and the loss that is inherent in every adoption, especially from the child's perspective. And that is that you cannot find, you know, a child can't find their forever family until they lose their first family, until they lose their first relationship, which is their relationship with their mother. And so that loss has very significant impacts for a child throughout their life, both in terms of that wound of being separated from one's birth mother, but then also the loss of their genetic identity and their larger kinship network and their extended family. And so while we do believe that adoption is redemptive when it's properly understood, we don't ever want to minimize that adoption begins with loss for children.
How does the family separation that's often experienced by immigrants show us the reality of adoption?
Well, I think that when we're talking about family structure, there is a tendency to minimize the harm of parental loss, whether it's through adoption, because we know the people who are adopting and we desperately want them to have a child. And obviously that has trickled over into the surrogacy debate that, oh, it's no big deal if kids lose a relationship with their mother at the day that they are born. But, you know, we don't carry that over to any other conversation. And we point out in the book, you know, that there was this outcry in 2018 when children were separated from their parents at the borders, you know, when these migrants were coming through the U.S.-Mexico border and policies dictated that children could not remain with their parents in custody. And we had mental health professionals decrying this and issuing statements talking about how the shrapnel of family separation is going to be embedded in their brains and result in lifelong trauma. And, you know, that it stands against everything that pediatricians are supposed to be for, which is protecting and promoting children's health. So why is it so obvious in situations like that, that we can all agree on are terrible and traumatizing for the child, right? That we look at these migrant families that are being separated and we go, this is an injustice. And then we turn around and we minimize it when it comes to the birth of a child and separating them from their birth mother or their first family or their surrogate mother. So it's just, we use that as an illustration of, in all of these other conversations, you know, families belong together. But when it comes to what adults want, whether that's definitely through a surrogacy arrangement, but even sometimes an improper understanding of adoption, we tend to minimize the loss and the impact that has on kids.
Do adopted children experience that genealogical bewilderment we've discussed before?
Yeah, they were the first ones to kind of have to wrestle through, why do I look different from my family? Where do I get my features? Who am I? Where do I belong? All of those questions that kids who grow up outside of a relationship with their biological parents, one or both, experience. And so genealogical bewilderment was a term that was coined originally to apply to adoptees. But now, as we've seen in the kids created through sperm and egg donation, that's something that they're wrestling with as well. This idea of it's, some of them say, you know, it's hard for me to look in the mirror. I don't know where I got my features from. So yes, that genealogical feeling like, you know, you are, you know, some of them have talked about, like, I feel like I'm an alien that was kind of dropped in the middle of this family and I'm totally different from everyone else. And that really unsettling, destabilizing sense of self that comes along with it. So, yeah, you know, as an adoptive mom, I can say I know that it's difficult for my son to look so different from the rest of his family. And so we have to help him work through those kinds of identity questions.
What does child-centered adoption actually look like?
What it looks like is, you know, I tell the story in the book of when I was working at the adoption agency. I used to work at the largest Chinese adoption agency in the world. And I came to my boss one day and I said, oh my gosh, I'm working so hard to get these adults approved. We've run into a couple roadblocks, but I'm working hard to make sure that we can get them a child that they really long for. And she looked at me and she said, no, you misunderstand. The parents might pay us, but they are not the client. The child is the client. And, you know, what that means is when adoption functions properly, every child that needs parents is going to find them. But not every adult who wants a kid is going to get one. And so the idea is just because adults want a child, that doesn't mean that they should be handed over a child. And that's why we have layers of screening and vetting for adoptive parents. So a proper understanding of adoption says, the child is the client. The child is at the center. We exist to serve the child's needs. We're not there to give every adult who wants a kid a kid.
Why do you say that adoption protects children's rights, but, and this is where confusion often exists, donor conception violates children's rights? Why is there confusion there, and what's the difference between the two?
Yeah, I think that there's a lot of people that think, well, donor conception is just another form of adoption, and maybe even better, right? Because adoptees have to lose both of their biological parents, but children created through sperm or egg donation usually only lose one of their biological parents. And a lot of people reason, well, if I support adoption, then I need to support donor conception because it's two different ways of, you know, forming a family. But that's not the case, right? Adoption protects children's rights. And donor conception violates children's rights. And we lay out four different reasons for that in the book. The first one is the one that I just mentioned, that In adoption, the child is the client. The idea is we are going to furnish the child with the best possible adoptive parents based on their needs. And not every adult who wants a baby is going to get one. But in the reproductive technology world, the adult is the client. And the idea is to get that adult, if they can pay for it, get that adult a kid, no matter the cost to the child and no matter the qualifications of the adult. And so there's a lot of people that are becoming parents through reproductive technologies that would not necessarily pass an adoption background check, because there are no background checks for reproductive technologies. You can walk out of the hospital with a baby who's not related to you at all as the full parent of a child in a lot of these states that are rewriting their parenthood laws. And that adult could never have acquired a child through the adoption process, because in adoption, there's actually layers of screening and vetting for adults who would like to become parents. That doesn't exist in the reproductive technology world. The second reason that we lay out is adoption mends a wound. Third-party reproduction inflicts a wound. So there is a wound when you lose your parent. You don't get to decide whether or not there's a wound. There is. Children are wounded if they lose a parent through adoption. Children are wounded if they lose a parent through reproductive technologies. The difference is that the adults who are raising the child in adoption are seeking to mend the wound. But the adults who are raising the child conceived through reproductive technologies are the adults who created the wound. And that leads to the third aspect. And that is that in adoption, the adults are filling a void for the children, but in third-party reproduction, the children fill a void for the adults. And what that means is the adults in adoption are much more likely to be supportive, understanding. They're able to mourn with their child when they're talking about the loss that they've experienced, because the adult didn't create the wound. With donor-conceived kids, they are much more likely to feel that they have to conceal the wound because they're being raised by the adults who inflicted it to begin with. So in those situations, a lot of times the kids created through sperm or egg donation feel like they have to support their parents. And finally, we talk about how adoption is sometimes necessary. There are tragic situations where birth parents aren't able to raise their children, and so sometimes those children need to be placed for adoption. Third-party reproduction is never necessary. It may be highly desired or sought after, but it's never necessary to create a mother or fatherless child. So we spend a lot of time on that in the book because, unfortunately, there's too much confusion about this. You can and should be a supporter of adoption and absolutely oppose all forms of third-party reproduction.
Finally, then, as we conclude our series, make the case for us that we need a global children's rights movement.
Well, all conversations about marriage and family should begin with, what about the kids? All policy conversations that have to do with marriage and family should begin with, what are the rights of children and how can we protect those rights as we move forward with this policy or this legislation? If we don't, then what we're doing is we are intentionally breaking the hearts of children, and we're also continuing to break society as a whole. And so everybody needs to become an expert on children's rights and what kind of implications there are in all these conversations first, because then we're going to be able to stand firm in conversations with friends, family, or on social media. Second, we're going to be able to support good policy that actually has very, very real consequences for children. And this needs to be global. I mean, the threats to children are crossing borders, so the movement has to be international. Like, we have to go where the threats go, and the threats are everywhere when it comes to redefining marriage into an institution that disregards the rights of children and focuses exclusively on the desires of adults, when it has to do with these reproductive technologies or surrogacy clinics that set up shop in poor brown nations all around the world. When it has to do with, like, divorce and the prevalence of divorce and the acceptability of divorce, the rise of polygamy and open marriages and non-monogamy that's being touted in the pages of the New York Times, like, literally monthly. I mean, all of these different issues are affecting countries all across the world. And so there's some threat to children's rights probably in your state or in your country right now. And nobody else is going to do this for you. Like, your celebrities won't. Academia is not going to do it. Most politicians don't have the political courage or the information to do it. So that means you have to do it. You, ordinary citizen, you, mom folding laundry while you're listening to this podcast, you and me. And so this has to be a movement of ordinary adults. And what we've done in this book is we have given you all the tools. This is the handbook for fighting for children's rights on this side of the womb. And I hope your listeners will join us.
Katie Faust is founder and director of the children's rights organization, Them Before Us. She's co-author of the new book, also called Them Before Us. You can purchase Them Before Us on the Talk on Demand archives page at issuesetc.org. Katie, thank you. Keep up the good work, and thanks for the series.
Thanks. Take care.
Our series, The Words of Scripture, continues on the other side of the break. We'll talk about the word judge. Pastor Will Wheaton of The Word of the Lord Endures Forever will be our guest.
Looking for a foreign language program that will revolutionize your students' vocabulary knowledge and their understanding of grammar? How about a program that teaches critical thinking skills, too? Look no further than Memoria Press's Latin curriculum. Students of all ages can use these Latin study programs. Give your students the gift of Latin today. To order, visit memoriapress.com and save $5 on your next order by using the coupon code LPR21. Memoria Press, saving Western civilization one student at a time.
Listen to the best of the church's music for the season of Lent at LutheranPublicRadio.org. Sacred music for the season of Lent, LutheranPublicRadio.org.
Solid, serious, substantive. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
Many educational institutions are governed by the whims of culture and are increasingly hostile to the Word of God. In contrast, Faith Lutheran School in Plano, Texas, provides classical Lutheran education rooted in God's Word for students preschool through grade 12. Simply put, we equip students to stand firm in the faith through solid education focused on wisdom and virtue. We offer in-person instruction as well as live online classes for remote learning. To learn more, visit flsplano.org, flsplano.org.
Have you ever wished you could see Ad Crucem's products before buying them? Well, now you can. Ad Crucem has opened our brand new workshop in Littleton, Colorado. Come visit us and watch how we make our Christmas ornaments. Check out the quality and fabric of our church banners, or choose some greeting cards, posters, icons, or jewelry. Of course, if you can't make it to Colorado, we are still open online. For details or directions, visit adcrucem.com. That's ADC. RUCEM.com.